Over the years, I have spoken about depression, been thinking about it for a long time now, and I've been asked to give different talks on it and called it different names. And this is one of the things, just how do we, the question that we're trying to address is how do we relate brain scans and brain biology and the Bible, the biblical view of depression. The other aspect of depression, of course, as we talked about yesterday, it is a profound subjective experience of your interior world beginning to fall apart. Glenn asked if any of you had been through periods like that, and I wrote a book on depression about 25 years ago, and about a year or two after that was published, actually no, it was just at the end of the year it was published, things began happening in my life, and it was almost like God saying to me, you think you know about depression? It's all up here, it's all academic, it's all what you've learned from your psychiatric and medical training. Let me teach you a few things. And that what happened was that my sister died in childbirth, which is a rare thing to happen nowadays. And then my wife got cancer. Thankfully, she recovered completely. My father-in-law died. And then 3 years to the day from my sister's death, her husband took his own life. And then following that, there were difficulties in work. There were responsibilities of teaching and preaching in the local church. And I was just getting overwhelmed by too many things and not having time to process all that had happened in my life. And I began to go down. And I began not to be able to make decisions very well. I was easily moved to tears. I wasn't sleeping very well. And it felt like I was sinking into a dark hole. Thankfully, there were friends around to help, to talk to. And I gradually came out of that. That was probably the worst experience in my life. And I realized that I'm vulnerable. We've been talking about this thing of being predisposed, that everyone gets to a point in their lives when they may go over the limit and you can't cope with things anymore. So it was a combination of losses and difficult circumstances in life. And then just a couple of years ago, I was going through a time of major indecision and some difficulties and overload, and I could feel the same things beginning to creep up on me again. I said to my wife at that point, I feel like I'm a ship that's sinking into the sea, and I'm just above the surface, but I'm going down. And so I eased back on some of my work. I took time to talk with someone, and gradually, again, that lifted off. But it was almost like being sucked into a whirlpool. You're on the edge of this dark hole. And it gave me a much better understanding of the experience of depression. Now, I would hate to go deeper into that hole that I began to fall into. I would hate to be in there for a long time, as some of you may have been. But it was good for me in another way. The Lord taught me subjectively what I was trying to teach others a bit about. Yesterday I did the workshop, one or two of you were at, on thinking about Abraham Lincoln's depression, and I'll come back to that a bit later on in the context of this. And more recently, I did another version of the book. This time it was called something a little different. It's called When Life Goes Dark, because that's really what it felt like and what it feels like for many people when they enter into depression. So the question that we're thinking about particularly today is depression sickness or sin? So some people, and if you read a lot in the secular press, and if you listen, especially in America, to the commercials, the advertisements on television, you would think that anyone who is depressed at all needs to take an antidepressant. They're sick, they're ill. And then there are others on the other end of the spectrum, Christians, who say, well, depression is a sin. If you're trusting God enough, if you're praying, if you're believing the Bible, then you won't get depressed. You'll be full of joy all the time. Another Christian counselor says depression comes as a result of a failure of self-control and self-discipline. Just got to be tough. You've got to tough your way through it. Well, as you look at those, there is an element of truth in all of them, isn't there? Because as we said yesterday, depression is complicated. It's the end point of psychological, sociological, family, personal, biological influences that all come together. So part of these may be true depending on the individual. And Glenn was talking about the people talking about the fact that we are in an epidemic of depression. The 20th century, the end of the 20th century, the beginning of the 21st century, seems that more people are depressed. And I think that's partially true with the turning away from Christianity, the breakdown of the family. A lot of changes and loneliness in big cities, the number of people living alone is huge. But there's also the fact that the drug companies, the pharmaceutical companies, fund most of the research on antidepressants. And they want doctors and mental health workers to diagnose depression and to put people on the pills. So it's partly also that it's being diagnosed more. This was a cartoon in the New Yorker magazine, and the caption says, "No wonder you feel good. These are loaded with antidepressants." And we've had people talking about an epidemic of depression and bipolar disorder in the United States in young people. And now they are beginning to realize they've gone too far in that. They're diagnosing it too much. They're backing off from that. Now, Glenn talked about the different signs of depression. And the way the instrument we use in the United States is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which has just been produced, the fifth version, a new one. And just to run through these to remind you of what he said in a slightly different way, we talk about a spectrum of mood from just feeling blue, feeling down, low, mild depression. And it's very important we keep the language of milder depression. We don't diagnose everything sad as depression with a big D. And then you get into severe depression and what we call clinical or major depression, which is this really intense, serious thing. Now, you don't have this in your notes, by the way, if you're trying to look for it, I'm afraid. I'm just doing a bit of a recap here. And this is where this sort of experience of an interior pain of your mind going crazy in some way that some authors describe. This man has written a wonderful little book that describes the experience of depression, William Styron. And some people get to the point where they are thinking about suicide all the time. So the way we talk about it is, the way we've been talking about this sort of more illness type of depression, you have to be depressed for at least part of the day or every day for at least 2 weeks. And you might not actually say you're feeling depressed. It might be just loss of interest in things. You have no pleasure in anything anymore. Plus at least four of the following things: of appetite and weight disturbance, so you might not be eating so much. Your sleep is disturbed, you're waking too early in the morning, or your young people often sleep on through into the middle of the day, not wanting to face the day. Often feeling fatigue and loss of energy that Glenn talked about. Some people get very anxious when they are depressed. So anxiety and depression can be mixed here. They may be quite agitated in their mood. And then feeling worthless, with feeling guilty about things that they don't need to feel guilty about. Their concentration is difficult. Their thinking is slowed up. And they may have suicidal ideas. And then when depression gets really serious, what we call psychotic depression, people may believe that they have cancer when there is no evidence that they have cancer. Or they may think they are giving off a terrible smell, as one of my patients did many years ago, where no one else can smell anything. So they are deluded. They're believing false things about themselves. And for the Christian, then often prayer feels like it's useless, and the Bible seems meaningless, and God seems very far away. So this feeling of, my God, why have you forsaken me, the psalmist says, is that sort of experience. Now, it's very important when you're listening to someone who's describing depression that you find out how long they've been depressed, how intense it is. If there are obvious causes, what's the sort of context in their lives for this experience? And in one study, they found that 43% of people who went to a doctor with depression were prescribed antidepressants, but they had no formal psychiatric diagnosis, and there was no follow-up at all, which shows how quickly the medical profession tends to jump to antidepressants as being the first line of treatment and doesn't really do anything else. And I would say that is bad practice, that we need to know much more. And that might be after only a 15 or 20 minute interview with the person. So I'm going to jump over these things to get to more the topic that of the polarity of moods that we live in. Glenn talked about some people experiencing both mania and depression, or recurrent episodes of mania. And this polarity of moods, we understand, is something that is abnormal, that was not what God intended us to have, these extremes. When God created Adam and Eve in the garden, they obviously had different feelings of joy, and we don't know where sadness came into that in the Garden of Eden. Maybe there wasn't much sadness at all, but there was an emotional range which is sort of somewhere in the middle here after the fall. We'll be talking more about the biblical framework in a moment here. But this is the sort of normal range that we live on, and we're saying that some people go to the extremes, and those are the ones who fit the more medical, biological model, where there's something going wrong with, severe going wrong with their brains and their psyches. And so the question for us, that was sort of more introduction and reminder of some of the themes that we covered yesterday. The question for us here is, what does it mean to bring the gospel to bear, to apply the gospel to the problems of life, whether it's depression, anxiety, or marriage problems, or homosexuality, or shame, perfectionism, all of these things. Now that of course depends on your answer to this question, doesn't it? What is the gospel? Can some of you give a little stab at how would you define what the gospel is? The good news, okay? The good news about what? Great. A holistic gospel of reconciling every part of creation to God again. Right, right. Okay, good. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, Phil. Okay. So Christ. So that the cross and the resurrection, we tend to think of as sort of the core, the heart of the gospel. Now, I grew up in what is a denomination called the Plymouth Brethren in England, and I learned every Sunday night I went to a gospel preaching. And there it was always about Jesus died for your sins so you could be forgiven and you could go to heaven when you die. That was the gospel, which is true. That's the sort of core of it, isn't it? But as Andrew has said, there is a much bigger dimension to the good news, isn't there? Were you going to come in on this? Okay, so that the truth about our adoption into God's family helps us enormously in dealing with issues of self-esteem, how we view ourselves, the sort of thing that Glenn was talking about the very first plenary session. Yeah, so that's a part of the gospel. Yes. Grace. God meets you just as you are, accepts you as you are. Right, right. Yeah, now these are all wonderful aspects of the gospel. What I want to emphasize is it's the sort of the bigness of the gospel. It's not just about the cross and the resurrection. That is the means by which God is rescuing us from our predicament. But the good news is there is a God. Yeah. He exists. And that he loves you, that he does accept you as you are, that he has come into the world to give us a remedy, to push back, a way to push back all the damage that has been done by sin and the fall. And one day he's going to complete that when he comes back again. So the question that we bring to bear in our talking with clients in counseling or people in our churches is what we're trying to do is to connect their individual story with the big story of God's rescue mission in the world, with the gospel. But it's not just preaching Christ crucified. That becomes a part of it along the way. So we are actually dealing in counseling here with a biblical anthropology. Now, big words, which basically anthropology is just a view of who people are. Who are you intended to be? Are you just the result of evolution and time and chance? Or is there something much more significant in who you are? So we're building a biblical anthropology and psychology. Now, this is where Glenn was talking about himself as an integrationist yesterday, and I have always called myself an integrationist all along. I'm beginning to change how I define myself as I've recently connected with the Society for Christian Psychology, an organization in the United States, which is really saying we need to start and make it very clear that we're starting from a Christian anthropology and worldview. We're building a psychology from a biblical, from the Bible, as it were, and we may use insights from the secular world in relation to things that the Bible doesn't explicitly talk about. So in that sense, there is integration. But I also want to make it clear that it's not just an integration of two equal things, of psychology and scripture. Scripture is the lens by which we view everything. And in that article that you haven't got yet, that's the what I'm talking about in that. And hopefully you will get it eventually. And Glenn referred to that, the biblical lens yesterday. So if we are, in a sense, making a gospel diagnosis and bringing to bear a gospel remedy, it is about the whole story of how God's story meets your story, right? What makes sense of what has gone wrong with our neurons and with the world in which we live, from the very microscopic level to the out to the heavens? What makes sense of all this? That's the question we're asking. And when we meet someone in pastoral care or in counseling, the first thing you need to have a clear view of is, who is this person before me? What are they intended to be? What was God's intention in the creation? And then you get to their individual story that we come to in a moment. So this picture, which I like very much in representing, you can't see it very well on this wall here, of the overarching story of creation here and the fall, the rebellion, as it were, against God's intention, and then redemption through the cross, and then the restoration of everything. So this is the story that we're caught up in, and we are waiting, longing for the restoration of all things, groaning for that, and we are living in the shadow of the fall, affected by it in all sorts of ways. So if you think of Adam and Eve in the garden before the fall, they had a deep sense of, we can think of their sort of psychological state of enjoyment and of trust and security in relationships. I'm just about coming to your notes now. and of significance and fulfillment in their work. There were no broken relationships, there was no frustration, there's no disease or death. There's complete integration and harmony and balance. Okay, their emotions and their thoughts are working together perfectly. Now, all of this is horribly disrupted by sin. Everything, the whole creation, and we get hints of it in Genesis 3 with the things that are described in Genesis 3. They don't describe all the details of how broken we are, but thorns and thistles come up to make gardening and farming a whole lot more difficult. There's pain in childbirth. There's disease. There's discord between Adam and Eve, between Adam and Eve and God. So there are a whole lot of areas of disintegration and alienation that result. So they have now needs and longings that are awakened for forgiveness, for acceptance, they have disturbing feelings of shame and of guilt, of failure, depression, anxiety, frustration. They have fears of rejection and punishment and loneliness and suffering and death. So it's a terrible change in what has happened here. And we might speak about it as the glory that they were given as made in the image of God to enjoy relationship with God. This glory is now ruined. Not completely. There are still remnants in us of the glory of the image of God. Francis Schaeffer used to use the expression, we are all glorious ruins. You know, you're like an ancient castle that is broken down. You can still imagine what it was like when it was in its glory, but now ivy grows all over it, the walls are broken down. And part of our task in counseling is to restore the glory. It will never be completed until Christ returns, but we are restorers of glory. Now think of the state of Adam and Eve in that as they began to realize what they had done. They didn't know the profound effects going down through the generations, but they had enough awareness in their own hearts. And if you've ever read John Milton's Paradise Lost, which I strongly recommend to you, because in his artistic way, he's imagining what it was like in heaven before Adam and Eve were created. And then when Satan came to them, and then when they fell, and he has Adam saying these words, "O miserable of happy, is this the end of this new glorious world, and me so late the glory of that glory?" Do you think he was depressed? I think he was profoundly. They were banished from the garden, and they began the intimacy they had now, they have to cover up. That the intimacy feels threatening. They are ashamed, both in relation to God and in relation to each other. They're guilty. They're sad. They're depressed. This is a tragic, tragic thing. And in a sense, we should know what it means, I think, to weep and to groan over a fallen world. So that a lot of what you do in counseling is very painful. You have no quick solution. You can't solve people's problems. You can't go in with the gospel pill and say, you know, take this 3 times a day and in a week you'll be better. We can just begin to see some of the healing that comes out of the gospel in people's lives, knowing that a lot of it will be in the future. So, and then of course, the ripples spread down through the generations with Cain and Abel. And in the story of Cain and Abel, you see Cain obviously was very jealous and envious that Abel's sacrifice was accepted and his wasn't. And God says to Cain, "You know what you have to do. You know what's right. And if you do it, if you don't do it, sin is waiting at the door to have you." It's almost like the devil, the beast, is waiting outside. If you disobey, then you're going to make life a whole lot more complicated by your disobedience. And Cain, it talks about Cain being downcast, depressed, Cain being angry, jealous, and this sort of downward avalanche of negative feelings eventually leads to murder when he takes his brother's life. So Cain was experiencing all these negative emotions that we've begun to talk about. Now, was he clinically depressed? I'm not saying that, but he certainly experienced a lot of depressive feelings. And then as you go on through the story in the New Testament, the whole human race is affected, in the Old Testament and the New Testament, the whole human race now is affected by Adam and Eve's sin and the effects of the fall. So that when we get to Paul's teaching in Ephesians and Romans, we hear about people being affected by darkness of mind and insensitivity and lust. So when a culture turns away from God, when individuals, Adam and Eve, turned away from God, and then when a culture turns away, there are profound negative consequences in their minds and in their relationships. So Romans talks about people suppressing the truth and then getting involved in idolatry, worshipping and serving the creature rather than the creator. And then all sorts of sins and brokenness emerge from that. And that's where we live today. So many of my students are idealistic about counseling when they start. And after the first year of counseling people, they tend to swing to cynicism and pessimism. They don't see the gospel doing any good to these people's lives. They're so broken, so damaged. They've been so damaged by other people's sin for generations of alcoholism, sexual abuse, and so on, and their own sin. And then as they move past that, they begin to become more realistic, somewhere between that idealism and cynicism. And we are called to be realistic about the brokenness of the world in which we live. So as we look at people and ask who they are, we find people are this amazing combination of dignity and depravity, of beauty and brokenness, and of glory and grief. Isn't that what you hear when you sit down and talk, listen to people's stories? You may sit down, as I often have with people, and I hear this story of maybe pornography and sexual addiction. And then as we move on, I hear about this man who is a brilliant musician and artist, all in the same person, this brokenness and beauty, the grief and the glory. And that's what you need to learn to listen for in counseling and in pastoring. Listen for those themes in people's lives and try and identify where is this part of the remnant of the image of God and where is this part of who they are as a broken, sinful person who has inherited all the brokenness that has come down through the generations. You probably know this well-known quote from Prince Caspian, C.S. Lewis. You come from the Lord Adam and the Lady Eve, said Aslan. That is both honor enough to erect the head of the poorest beggar on earth and shame enough to bow the shoulders of the greatest emperor on earth. It's a wonderful picture of the two sides of our dignity and our depravity. So as you sit with people in counseling, you not only think about who they are from God's perspective and who are human beings, but you also then now begin to get into their story. Who is this unique individual? They're unlike anyone else, and I have to respect them and love them in the way that God does, and I have to have a curiosity about them to enter into their life and walk with them and try and understand what they are experiencing. So we listen well to these stories. And we listen too, not only for the themes of dignity and depravity, but we listen also for the themes of being sinned against and being a sinner, of being an inheritor of the sins of Adam and Eve, the fallen world. But in most people's stories who are depressed, you're going to hear all of these themes, aren't you? How much they have been sinned against, and then how maybe they, in response to being sinned against, have sinned themselves. But you don't start with their own sin until you've listened to the whole story and moved through a whole lot of other things. And then in doing that, in listening to their stories, then we have the task as Christian counselors of connecting their stories to the biblical stories, don't we? How do we use scripture in counseling? Well, I don't often actually quote texts at people. I don't prescribe a text like a prescription and say, just read this three times a day. Although sometimes, occasionally, I will do that. But rather, I want to help them to listen to, and I love the Old Testament, because the Old Testament is full of, how does God teach us in the Bible? He teaches through stories, doesn't he? So often. Now, Paul's letters are a little more didactic and sermonic, but so much of the teaching is just examples of people's lives in stories. So if you think of the story of Naomi and Ruth, which I absolutely love, it's one of my favorite stories in the Bible. And I was in Ethiopia a couple of years ago, and I was asked to do a Bible study for women whose husbands all had AIDS, and some of them had AIDS, and their children had AIDS. They were living in the poorest slums of the city. Many of them had moved from different outlying country areas of Ethiopia to the city, looking for work, trying to survive. And they were linked up with a Christian mission there and were being given a lot of help. But they, as I talked with them, and I realized for myself, they're much more in touch with the story of Naomi and Ruth than I am. This is their life. You remember how Naomi, because of a famine, had to go with her sons and her husband to a completely alien culture, foreign land. She lost her own family, her country, and she went to this country far away, which was a pretty godless place, and lived there as an immigrant. She lost her husband, she lost her two sons. And then when the famine was over, she returned with her two daughters-in-law to her homeland. And one of the daughters went back, didn't come with her. Ruth comes with her. And Naomi at one point says, as she comes back to the town of Bethlehem, and the women said, "Is this Naomi?" You know, she was barely recognizable. She was probably so haggard with grief and sorrow and travel. "Don't call me Naomi," she said. "Naomi," she says, "call me Mara," which means bitterness. "For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" Was she depressed? Well, she was grieving. She was deeply sad. She was in a lot of pain. She was angry with God. She was feeling God had abandoned her. And she is a believer. And gradually in this wonderful story, you see God touching Ruth and Naomi with little touches of kindness from people who begin to bring restoration and rescue to their situation. And Boaz is a sort of classic example of the perfect gentleman who treats, in that culture, does some very unusual things in treating Ruth with incredible dignity. And eventually Ruth marries him, and they have a child, and of course the child is an ancestor of Christ himself. So it's a wonderful biblical story that relates to a lot of people struggling with the sorts of things that these Ethiopian women had struggled with. If you think of Job, and Job's, you know, the number of losses that he went through, and he was dealing with grief for what, almost 40 chapters of the book of Job, where he's complaining, he's pouring out his grief to God. And eventually God, in a sense, says, "Come for a walk with me in the garden and get perspective in terms of I am in control of this universe." But Job is it's wonderful, I think, that the book of Job is there. Abraham Lincoln loved to read the book of Job. In the later years of his life, he would often be seen sitting for hours reading a book. Now, I don't think he was a believer. He in fact, his parents were strict Baptists, a very strict, hyper-Calvinistic sect. And he broke away from that, became a freethinker. But in the later years of his life, after he dealt with a lot of suffering, I think what he would call, what he would be what I would call today, a liberal Presbyterian, he believed in God, but I'm not sure where he was in relation to Christ. But he said, maybe. But he certainly loved the Book of Job. He found consolation in that. And if you think of what Job writes in chapter 30. "And now my soul is poured out within me. Days of affliction have taken hold of me." This wasn't just a day or two. The night racks my bones, and the pain that gnaws me takes no rest. "You have turned cruel to me. With the might of your hand, you persecute me. And when I hoped for good, evil came. And when I waited for light, darkness came. My inward parts are in turmoil and never still." That's a pretty good description of depression, isn't it? Now, grief tends to come in waves. Depression tends to be pretty consistent. That's one of the differences. Grief has a very clear cause in terms of loss, and usually there's a healthiness and a rightness to going through a grief process, isn't there? Over months, maybe a year or two after you've lost someone precious. So he had every reason to be in the depths of grief. And grief and depression have many similar characteristics. about 10% of people who are grieving go on and get stuck in complicated grief, and it quite often moves into clinical depression. So there's overlap, but there's also distinction here. And I would see Job as very much in the sort of overlap area in this particular quote. He's experiencing a lot of the same things as depression, but he has every reason to be in deep grief. And then if you go on into the other stories of the Old Testament, Elijah, these next few men, the four men, Elijah, Moses, Jonah, particularly, and Job, we could include, I call that the suicidal saints, because they all got to a place where, well, Job said, I wish I'd never been born. It's almost like, I wish I'd been aborted when I was in my mother's womb. The other three get to a point, this common end point of saying, God, if this is the way things are, I just want to die. Take my life. So Elijah, you remember, after this great victory with the prophets of Baal, he's probably exhausted, and he comes down off this wonderful victory of faith, and Jezebel says, I'm out to get you, Elijah. And he turns into a shivering jelly, and he runs off down country and about 200 miles out into the desert and hides in a cave in the mountain. And God comes to him and says to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? Great question, isn't it? Not just once, but twice. What are you doing here, Elijah? And he doesn't answer him in the big signs of the whirlwind and the storm. He comes with that still, small voice. And, you know, we learn, I think, from the way God counsels people that there are very powerful little questions that you can drop into people's hearts. You don't give them a sermon. You don't give them a lecture. You don't give them a fix. You ask them a good question that where they have to say, as Elijah did, yeah, what am I doing here? Why have I become so fearful? What's happened to me? And you remember on the way, on that long journey to the mountain, God had met him in terms of feeding him, nourishing his body, making sure he got enough sleep because he was exhausted. And that can lead to depression, physical exhaustion, overwork, burnout. Think of Moses getting to the same end point. He had the anger of God with the people on one side and the people angry with him on the other. He's got this gigantic congregation. He's a pastor with a congregation of over 1 million people out in the wilderness, and they're angry with him, as some pastors experience with their flock. And so he's sort of mediating between God and them, and he doesn't know very well how to delegate. Eventually, his father-in-law teaches him to delegate. But he's at a crisis point. I think Moses, being somewhat perfectionist, probably thinking a bit in all or nothing terms. And he says, Lord, I can't do this. I've had enough. And intriguing again, with all of these men, God doesn't give them a sermon. He just comes alongside them and doesn't condemn them. And if you think of Jonah, Jonah is in another completely different situation where Jonah has been given this task, having run away. God recommissions him, and he comes back and goes and preaches to Nineveh the judgment of God if they don't repent. And then he goes outside the city and sits down to wait for God to judge the city. And God decides that they've repented and he's going to forgive them. And Jonah doesn't like this a bit. He says, come on, nuke them, God, get them, you know, destroy these people. And God doesn't do it. And Jonah is angry with God again. And you remember what God does with Jonah? He comes to him and he asks him a question. Do you have a right to be angry, Jonah? Twice. And essentially that's where the book ends. You are left as the reader, as the listener, with that question of, is there anger in my heart that is unrighteous? Why am I angry with this person who's betrayed me, or with God for letting me down and allowing me to be depressed. So it's God coming. God doesn't condemn Jonah. He just asks this powerful question that rests in his heart. And you remember with Job, as I said, Job, in a sense, God says to Job, I'm in control of this universe. Just look at the evidence. And in a way, he's saying to Job, maybe Job, you've been grieving for long enough. You've been complaining for long enough. It's time to stop. It's time to move on in that. And then when you come to the Psalms, David and the other psalmists, we know these well. This is often the place that is the most thumbed in our Bibles, the most well marked, because it is the experience that we all have so often. And most of the psalms express, there are far more lament psalms than there are praise psalms. So there's something about in our churches and in dealing with people in counseling, we need to help people to learn to lament, to learn to grieve, both corporately and individually. So a lot of time when you're counseling people who have been terribly sinned against, who've been abused, who've been neglected, whose parents maybe have got divorced and don't have much to do with them, you're helping them to tell the story and to learn what it means to grieve, to say, this was really sad what happened to me. And I've never really realized how sad it was. You're also maybe helping them to be righteously angry and then to take them into the process of learning to forgive. So this is all the part of the counseling in relation to depression, when you're talking about people's stories that have led them to this end point of depression. But to be able to say to someone you're counseling, go home and write your own psalm. Read Psalm 13, and then write your own psalm. Use the same pattern that David used. What would you say? Or write your own lament in the style of Lamentations. That's an incredibly powerful and moving thing to be able to do. So the psalmist says, my tears have been my food day and night. Sorry, I'm disconnected here. Well, how long must I wrestle with my thoughts and every day have sorrow in my heart? And then there's that Psalm 88, which I love that it's there. It ends, the very last verse is, the darkness is my closest friend. It took a long time, probably, to get through that particular episode of being depressed. Were these people clinically depressed? I'm not sure I would put them in that category. We don't know how long they went through these experiences, but Psalm 22 describes some very powerful physical symptoms of being abandoned, being forsaken, being depressed. And then you could go on to look at Jesus' tears before the tomb of Lazarus. He was grieved. He was angry at the fact of death and of separation. He was deeply moved in spirit, it says. He wept. You can think of him weeping over Jerusalem, longing for, weeping over the rebellion and the brokenness that had come about through sin. And then at the Garden of Gethsemane, we read in Hebrews of, in the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death. So he suffered not necessarily clinical depression, but he suffered a sense of desolation, of deep sadness, of discouragement. And then Paul talks about being sorrowful yet always rejoicing. This, when we live in a fallen world, you experience a lot of sorrow and grief, but you also have the joy at the same time of knowing this isn't the whole story. There is hope in the gospel. There is a God who's going to come back one day. and to, as John says in Revelation, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more, neither shall there be mourning and crying or pain anymore. So when we think about the question of do Christians get depressed, they do get depressed. Some of you have been depressed. You've certainly been very discouraged, like many of these biblical writers. Some of you have been into the dark places of where your brain, the fallenness of your brain takes over, and you get into something that sort of whirlpool that sucks you down, where you may need antidepressants. It becomes more like an illness that Glenn was describing. And if you look at men through history, some Christian, some not Christian, Martin Luther struggled with depression. He's written a number of things on it. You can just Google Luther and depression, and you'll come up with some of his very practical and wise advice about his experiences. William Cowper, or Cowper, was an English hymn writer. We still sing some of his hymns. In his late teens and early 20s, he tried to commit suicide several times. And the last 7 years of his life were in the depths of a very dark depression. And there were dips down into depression along the way. So here is a profound believer with a profound understanding of the gospel who still is experiencing living in the shadow of the fall and all that that meant for him. Charles Spurgeon, the great preacher, suffered from some bouts of pretty serious depression. Lincoln, I'll come back to again in a moment, and Winston Churchill, some famous women, both contemporary and in the past, Christina Rossetti and Emily Dickinson, Judy Garland. These are all people who have talked about their episodes of depression quite publicly or written about it. Gwyneth Paltrow, the actress and the author of the Harry Potter series, J.K. Rowling. And as you look back in history, it's really intriguing to me that in the Puritans understood depression in very similar terms to the way we do today. Richard Baxter, in his Causes and Cures of Melancholy and Overmuch Sorrow, it's a lovely title, isn't it? He speaks about this interaction between the biological and the psychological and the spiritual. He's recognized that there was some melancholy that was so deep that spiritual remedies did not work, and that these people needed more than that. Now, in those days, they didn't know quite what to do with them, apart from talking and all sorts of pretty horrific treatments. And then in the 1800s, John Calhoun writes, he describes depression very much in the terms that we would describe it today, a believer feeling that everyone's against him, that God is against him. He can't stop crying. He's dejected all the time. They're very graphic descriptions of what we talk about as depression today. Now, Lincoln, and I can only have time just to give you a brief glimpse. What's intriguing is that you see many of the factors that we've talked about that lead to depression in his life. When his mother died when he was 9, and she suffered from pervasive sadness, he had an uncle who was crazy, and most of this uncle's children were pretty crazy too, with different forms of mental illness. So there was, a genetic loading on him. His brother died in infancy, so he suffered childhood loss. His only sister died after childbirth when she was about 20. And he, at age 26, which is a common age for people, young men, to have depression, he suffered his first depression, and that's when his friends locked him up so that he wouldn't commit suicide. And that was partly a result of the loss of a close woman friend, Nobody's sure quite what their relationship was, but he used to visit her every day when she was sick. And he was also apparently very sensitive to the weather. And there was it was a terrible winter that year, very cold, very wet. He had another episode at about the age of 31. This was after he split up with his fiancée, who he later actually married. He'd trained himself to be a lawyer on his own, so he had a legal practice and he had a very heavy workload. A good friendship with a man friend that he'd been friends with all his life ended. And again, there was a terrible winter. And then his third depression, as he got older, it seems like he became more able to cope with it. And the means he used to write poetry a lot. It was pretty depressive poetry. He read Shakespeare's tragedies a lot. He eventually got round to the Book of Job, read that a lot. But he would sit for hours, and in the movie, if you've seen it, you know that he has this sort of very melancholic look. And he would sit in the chair for hours on end in this sort of depressed stupor. But he also was able to come out of it. As he got older, he seems like he was able to get out of it more easily. He had horrendous marriage difficulties. I don't have time to go into it. He lost his son. He lost actually two sons. One son died at the age of 3, another at the age of 11. His father died. He had a very difficult relationship with his father. And around all of this, he then gets elected as president. Because he was a remarkably gifted man. And he was another way he dealt with his depression was that he talked about it a lot. He wasn't ashamed, so he would tell people that he was really depressed, which I think was a really helpful thing. And then he was a great storyteller and joke teller. And this was his way, I think, of sort of distracting himself from the depressive thoughts, was to tell jokes. And he had a fund of jokes. He'd gather people around him, tell stories. But then when he was president, he also found his real calling and meaning in life, which was to fight slavery. And that gave him a sense of purpose. He'd had a purpose in becoming a lawyer. That was his earlier purpose. But now he had this colossal responsibility. And then he takes the country into the Civil War over slavery. And what some people have said is that depressive people, and there's quite a lot of research on this, depressed people actually are very realistic about life. They see life more realistically than the optimists. And Lincoln was a bit like this, and one author says, in many instances, depressives may simply be judging themselves and the world more accurately than non-depressed people and finding it not a pretty place. And Lincoln, another writer about depression, Peter Kramer, says, throughout history, it's been known that melancholics, though they have little energy, use their energy well. They tend to work hard in a focused area. They do great things and derive little pleasure from their accomplishments. Much of the insight and creative achievement of the human race is due to the discontent, guilt, and critical eye of dysthymics. So what he's saying here, I think, is that people who are sort of chronically depressed, dysthymic meaning this sort of chronic depression, actually can achieve a lot in life. And it gives them something to do to fight off their depressive thoughts. So this, I think, is very much the story of Abraham Lincoln. This is how he survived and his deep, dark, depressive times and his melancholic character. So that's a little bit about some people, and I need to draw to a close here so that we have a little time for discussion. And I'm going to jump ahead to near the end of this. Just to summarize, where am I going to? We've seen, as Glenn pointed out, and we've talked about today, that the many different causes of depression. It's a complicated thing. The biological, the psychological, the social, the spiritual, the demonic. So the big question for all of us that we have to grapple with, all of us and how we help our clients, is how do we reduce their vulnerability? And I'm just going to name these because we've talked about them as we've gone along, because I want to finish very soon and get on to some discussion. We need to learn to talk to ourselves, and in the way that David did in the Psalms, of why are you cast down, O my soul? We need to learn to talk in prayer to God, to friends, to counselors, to pastors. As I said about Lincoln, he was not ashamed to talk about how depressed he was, to write about it. And I think that really helped him through his times. And we need to learn to be in touch with the full range of human emotions. For people who have grown up in abusive or alcoholic homes, they have a really hard time naming what they're feeling. So as a counselor, you spend a lot of time helping them to put names to feeling. This is sadness. This is shame. You know, this is depression. This is anxiety, fear. And when you name it, then you begin to know what you can do about it, how you can bring, as it were, the biblical remedy to bear on that. Learning to grieve well. I don't think I learned to grieve until I was about 40. And now I'm a lot more able to cry, a lot more able to grieve and to recognize that it's a good thing when I lose things or lose people. And then looking at your own heart, this is what I would call the heart surgery of counseling, in the sense of looking at your relationships, your expectations of life, your desire to be in control of everything, your black and white thinking. Just what are the thinking patterns that Glenn talked about yesterday that we get caught in? We need to work with those and on them. And dealing with bitterness and relationship problems and disappointment with God. You know, you could go on listing many, many things like this that we get into in as we talk with people about their stories. Which may lead us to a place where they need to come to a place of repentance before God, of some particular sin or idolatry or unconfessed area in their life. And helping them to know what it means to resist the lies of the devil. So often people who have lived in very broken situations in their early lives have come to believe things that are really untrue about God and about themselves and about the world around them. So you're helping them to name truth and lies. That's another big part of what we do in counseling. And maybe working with their marriage, with their family in marriage counseling. And then the sort of the practical common grace remedies of exercise, of eating healthy diet, not using alcohol to dull the pain, getting enough sleep. I think that fish oil is good for anything that goes wrong with your body or your brain. Things like this that are useful remedies for all of us in pushing back depression and anxiety. And then medication if necessary. And we talked, I think, enough about that, and finding the right dose, finding the right medication that you may have to juggle, which antidepressant suits the particular person. And then the bigger picture is meditating on the gospel, on the bigger picture of what is the purpose of your life, what are you called to? And understanding God's grace and love that gives you the ability to endure the times of suffering and difficulty and loss. And I think it's good also to be able to care for others who are worse off than yourself. That sometimes helps you to regain perspective. when you're feeling particularly down. So the hope and the healing, the application of the gospel, is in learning to have your mind renewed by retraining your brain, which, as Glyn showed us yesterday, the brain is changed by what you think and what you do. So the more you think and do what God has called you to do and think, the more your brain will be sanctified. You'll be pushing back against the fall. The image of God is restored in you, and you learn what it means to wait the completion of that, that one day you will be completely restored, you will be completely healed. The groaning, the tears will be over. And it's that picture that we have to help our clients, the people we counsel, to see more clearly, whether it's through preaching on these great themes, these great stories of the Bible, or on one-on-one in counseling, applying them to their own lives.